There's a West African proverb I've often shared. It goes, "One must come out of one's house to begin learning." Those were the operative words of this broadcast in our 8-plus years on the air. Get our cameras out of the studio and out into the world to learn from you about what's broken and what's working. We've come to the end of that journey. This program is the last broadcast of Now on PBS. A different news program starts next week on many PBS stations called Need to Know, and I'll be watching. But before we go, a final look at just some of what we have learned during our run. Brenda Breslauer, Mona Iskander, and Larry Goldfein produced the piece. It's fair to say these past 8 years have been quite an adventure for us here at Now on PBS. We've traveled from one end of the country to the other and beyond.
From Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Yes, that Guantanamo Bay. Our story begins in Michigan, Fort Stewart, Georgia, Yellowstone National Park.
That's Minneapolis, Minnesota, behind me here. Coming to you from a random commercial strip here in Fast Food Nation.
We've gone on the road from the vast open plains of the American West to the streets of our country's biggest and smallest cities and towns.
I don't know of any place in this country that there's anything more beautiful as far as country goes.
We've journeyed across the globe to, for instance, the remote and fragile islands of the South Pacific.
It's too late for countries like us. If we could achieve zero emission as a planet, still we would go down.
To the tops of glaciers.
I feel comfortable with this stuff, so I can go up and down it.
I'm glad you feel comfortable.
Senior correspondent Maria Hinojosa took us to the villages of sub-Saharan Africa.
In the village of Magagirogo, women tell us they had no say in choosing when and who they married.
Ask them all how many of them, if they could raise their hand, were 15 or younger when they got married.
Our travels led us into the hearts and minds of young people in the Middle East, from soldiers in Israel to students in the Arab world. And we've met some unforgettable people.
He looks like you, this one.
Our time on the air spanned a tough and tumultuous decade. It began with the New York Financial District's great symbol of commerce, the World Trade Center, targeted for mass murder. And it ended with Main Street reeling from the economy that Wall Street helped create. Throughout, we chronicled the lives of ordinary Americans and how the changing economic landscape put new strains on families.
Come on, let's go to the park.
Back in 2002, we met the Caputos, who moved from New York to Pennsylvania to find an affordable home to raise their four children. But the family is paying a big price. Every day, Ron Caputo gets up at 3 a.m. and is in his car by 4 to commute to his job in New York, 3 hours and 125 miles away.
I usually leave in between 4 and 4:30 in the morning. From my house to the ICE-LIP office is roughly 3 hours. Well, I like to get home usually around by 10 o'clock, so I'm getting a good solid 5 hours of sleep. You know, I get a little time to unwind with the wife. And then we just do it again.
Do you get to spend as much time with your family?
No. I spend a lot of that time on the road.
Over the years, we reported on growing income disparities among Americans. In Alabama, Maria Hinojosa showed how a state sales tax at grocery stores was disproportionately affecting the poor. Meet Callie Greer.
While she and her husband both work, Callie struggles every day to find a way to stretch her dollars far enough to feed a family of three. On top of every grocery store purchase here in Alabama, there's an additional tax Callie has to consider. It works out that people at the bottom are paying nearly 11% of their income in taxes, while those at the very top are only paying 4%. On this shopping trip, Callie notices that milk is on sale.
We're going to get a gallon. We're splurging.
Moments later, though, her daughter Naya says she wants bagels this week. So Callie reconsiders and puts the gallon back on the shelf.
So we're going to actually get the half gallon. So I'm like, okay, we might need to do something else.
It's always like that.
Most of the time it's like that.
Get this, but we can't get that?
Yeah. You know, it's not like we can come in every week and say we can get milk. for a whole week. Week before last, we had no milk.
And in these tough economic times, we met American families falling deeper and deeper into debt. Like Gina Moss, whose crushing debt from student loans led her and her five-year-old daughter to lose their home.
I still can't make enough money to take care of her. It's very sad.
We were there as they packed up to leave their home.
Any artwork that you want to get rid of, we can't keep it all.
But I like it all too much. It's hard for me because I won't get rid of anything. I just love it all too much.
And I really thought I was going to have a better life than my parents and have so many more opportunities. And I don't think that's true.
Gina joined a tidal wave of Americans who have lost their homes in the last few years. As the recession deepened, we chronicled the foreclosure crisis and the devastating effect it had and continues to have across the country, spreading like a virus in some communities. Welcome to Shelby County, a region that includes Memphis. Here in the Fraser neighborhood, the foreclosure wave has been the financial equivalent of a neutron bomb. People disappear, but the structures are left standing.
Every one of these houses is a failure. Somebody went bankrupt. Somebody got sick. 60% of the people that we run into are losing their houses have been ill. Broke a leg. Had a heart attack. Something. And it suspended their income.
Once, twice, third and final call, sold $58,000.
With foreclosed homes being auctioned off day after day, we went to ask Congress how the federal bailout was trickling down to the people on the ground. Elijah Cummings is a congressman whose Baltimore district has been hit hard. How much of the $700 billion bailout has gone to help troubled homeowners?
Zero.
Zip.
That's right.
Not a penny.
Not a penny.
We have developed a peculiar form of capitalism where the wizards of Wall Street walk away with the profits and we, the American people, walk away with the losses.
As inequality grew in America and as environmental disasters mounted, we wanted to know who the policymakers were who dropped the ball. And where was the oversight?
Nice to meet you.
My colleagues and I took these questions to the people in power.
We're talking about Kerr McGee.
And I don't know anything about Kerr McGee.
You don't know anything about Kerr McGee?
Will you leave, please?
Can you tell us why, under your leadership, Johnny Burton, the royalties collected by auditors have dramatically decreased by MMS?
Does the White House's Office of Management and Budget have the authority to downplay the health effects of mercury like this?
How do you explain that the LAPD had thousands of unopened, untested rape kits sitting on the shelves?
Do you think we have a case here where the state of Texas executed an innocent juvenile offender?
If you didn't have the data, and you're a data-based credit rating agency, why not walk away?
The revenue potential was too large.
And our questions took us all the way to the White House.
I'm wondering about your response to charges that you were, in fact, spinning the media, and as a result, the American public, when you consistently said in the Valerie Plame case that Scooter Libby and Karl Rove had nothing to do with it.
For months and months and months, we've said that we're not going to comment on the investigation while it's ongoing.
2.5 years after dodging that question, White House spokesman Scott McClellan admitted he was unwittingly involved in the Valerie Plame cover-up. And there were startling admissions made on our air. In February 2006, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Chief of Staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell, told me this about the administration's case for war.
I participated in a hoax on the American people, the international community, and the United Nations Security Council. How do you think that makes me feel?
We investigated how a lack of government regulation of toxics was putting our children at risk, including mercury in our waters.
I didn't know anything of mercury as a poison. All I knew was mercury was a planet, and I was not related to a planet. And so when my mom says, I think you might have mercury poisoning, I'm like, I never went to mercury.
And we questioned why our government wasn't doing its best to protect our children from a class of chemicals called phthalates.
So the European Union bans phthalates based on the work, or in large part based on the work, on what American scientists are finding out about phthalates?
Yeah.
And yet we don't ban it here.
Exactly. That's exactly what's happening.
And we didn't just address problems. We also looked at innovative solutions offering hope for those on the edges of society. We reported on a way to save cities money by getting homeless people off the streets and out of danger. It turns out emergency room visits drop and money is saved by getting homeless people into free, safe apartments of their own. In 2007, I got to spend time with Edward Doyle, nicknamed Footy, for the miles that he used to trudge on foot through Manhattan.
This is it? This is where you live?
Yeah.
Upstairs?
Mm-hmm.
The other day, I went to visit Footy in his new place.
Well, Footy, look at this. This is really cool. This is your place.
There's no way to tell if ultimately Footy can keep it together enough to make this apartment work long term, but so far, so good.
How about the seizures? Have you had any of these?
I haven't had none lately.
You feel differently somehow, living in this kind of place?
Yeah, I feel differently. I feel happier, too. I'm glad I got my own place. I live happily ever after.
In 2004, we met young people from D.C.'s tough streets who, in the face of gang violence, found a sense of purpose in an environmental program that gave them tools to improve their communities. When they got out on the Anacostia River, they saw their lives in a new way.
Jerome Scott says he wants to protect wildlife along the river.
I want to be a zoologist, a marine biologist, anything that has to do with animals. I love it.
Because remember, while he's out of water, he's holding his breath.
Picture Jerome Scott through the eyes of these kids from the inner city.
You never see a black guy on a boat teaching environmental sciences. So by seeing a black guy from D.C. on a boat teaching you about pollution and environmental, aquatic vegetation, that sort of thing, it makes it more of a reality that you can achieve it yourself. The kids think that the river is so dirty, you know, that there could be no way fish could be living in it, but sure, there is fish living in it. There's some strong fish, you know, and I love the way their intensity, their fight, you know, to stay in this river.
So you love the fact that they're survivors.
They're surviving. They're surviving fish. Exactly.
Throughout our years on the air, we covered politics early and often in an effort to paint a broad picture of what the country was thinking from the ground up. Our reporting took us to the battleground states, from beauty salons in South Carolina.
I'm for Hillary.
Why are you for Hillary?
She's a woman. I'm a woman.
A woman can do it better.
To conversations with Latino voters in Florida and undecided women voters in Colorado.
I'm still on the fence. I'm close. Going that way.
In New Mexico, we met 31-year-old Victor Montoya, a tireless volunteer for the Obama campaign. He canvassed door-to-door in this neglected community, hoping for a better future.
I've seen too many young people get killed. I've seen too many young people become drug addicts because they're not encouraged. No one's asking them to be part of the process. And when people are thrown into the fire, well, you know, that's all they know.
Montoya plans to use what he's learned to keep mobilizing his neighbors.
We need to be part of the system. We need to be able to bridge community organizing and politics, just like Barack Obama has. He's really giving me the courage to do this.
In South Carolina, we discovered that vicious political mudslinging is a treasured pastime.
If I'm advising a candidate running for office at any level today, my advice is buckle your chin strap and have your house in order, because they're coming after you.
Good morning, Central Huskies!
In 2007, we even introduced many viewers to their first look at Sarah Palin, well before she was picked as Senator McCain's running mate.
The former beauty queen, small-town mayor, and mother of four is a conservative Republican who ran for office last year and won, promising to clean up corruption in her own party. Before the elections, Palin was considered a long shot. But her plain-spoken style and willingness to be tough on the oil industry has made her wildly popular here.
And the health care debate. Over the years, we reported on how the problem of affordable care has been consuming families across the country, like the O'Reillys of Oklahoma.
I have asthma, and sometimes it makes it harder for me to run as fast as other kids.
In 2006, Sophie underwent major surgery to take out an entire lobe of her tiny lung.
We've had to, you know, sort of keep a cap on our lives and how we planned our lives based on this one factor, healthcare.
I say to people pretty frequently, because they're like, oh, you know, my plan works great for me. And my answer to that is insurance works really well until you need it, until you really, truly need it.
In Nevada, we spent time with a young family as they were coping with the erosion of a public health system that had abandoned them. The couple's son, Rafael Jr., has a condition called tracheobronchomalacia. Baby Rafael's airways are so weak that over the next 2 years, he'll have to depend on this ventilator to keep breathing. Baby Rafael is coming home with complicated medical equipment, which requires monitoring 24 hours a day. It took paramedics to make sure he got home safely. And until recently, a nurse would come in to lend a hand to parents with kids that have such specialized medical needs. But because of Nevada's increasingly tight Medicaid budget, Rafael's parents are on their own. At 11 that night, Rafael's mom, Janet, starts the first of what will be a series of non-stop overnight shifts. She knows that if she falls asleep, her baby's life could be in jeopardy. Sick families, and what scientists say is a sick Earth. To dig into the story of climate change, we took our cameras across the globe.
I've come to Bangladesh to see how people here are adapting to life in a world shaped by water. This is what the future could look like for much of the planet if the current pace of climate change continues. With 230 rivers and a huge coastline, water is everywhere. It comes from the sky. It comes from Himalayan glaciers melting to the north. And more, it comes from the sea.
And from a place with too much water, we went to a place with too little water. We trekked to the top of the world, the Himalayas. It takes a whole lot longer to reach the face of the glacier and the mouth of the river than it did a century ago because it's melted back so far. There it is, a wall of ice hundreds of feet tall. To get an idea of the scale, look at these pilgrims, tiny specks in front of the massive glacier. Disappearing glaciers threaten the rivers they feed and the people who use those rivers for sustenance. From environmental tragedies to human ones, we visited Guatemala and found a very different but urgent story, child brides.
If you are poor, indigenous, and you're a woman or a girl in Guatemala, what are the options for your future?
You don't have options.
One of those young women is Brenda. She's married and about to have a baby.
¿Cuántos años tienes?
13.
We witnessed even younger children being married off illegally when our special report on child brides took us to India.
Tonight we've been invited to attend the wedding of two child couples. So we're going in undercover with a hidden camera.
The brides were no more than 3 or 4 years old. The grooms, one wearing a special crown with flashing lights, were also children, no more than 6 or 7.
We went to the Middle East to explore efforts to grant Palestinians more autonomy over their lives, like building up their own security forces with the goal of a more stable and peaceful region.
On patrol, I spoke with Alaeddin Abdelatif, a recruit in training. His story is testament to just how much has changed in Jenin. He used to be a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade,
a violent militia that sought to end Israel's presence in the West Bank by attacking Israeli settlers and sending suicide bombers into Israel.
I was an ignorant young man, and I got involved with a group of guys from my town who were part of the resistance.
He says he spent his life on the run, evading capture by the Israelis. But now he finds himself leading a very different life, fighting for change within the system when once he lived outside of it.
We've always felt that our kind of journalism needs also to lift up the best in us by highlighting folks pursuing solutions on the ground that empower people and improve their lives at home and abroad. One example is from a slum in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Kenyans and Americans were working together to bring the same kind of marketing ideas used to sell donuts and foot-long sandwiches in the U.S. right to Kenya's healthcare system.
I've never had the chance ever to say, I might be able to save somebody's life. I may be able to save more than one life. And that's a heady kind of statement for a guy who just does franchising.
Side is in Kenya to evaluate a franchise called Child and Family Wellness Shops, or CFW Shops. That's the brand right there. It's a network of tiny drugstores and medical clinics, each owned and operated by Kenyans. Dora Nyanja is a nurse who runs one of them.
You're not here 7 days a week, are you?
David, you cannot afford to close a single day here.
Driving all this is the hope that the entrepreneurial spirit of Kenyans trained in healthcare, harnessed by the franchise business model, could become a powerful new tool to take on the African health crisis.
I do hamburgers, and I do hot dogs, and I do hotels, and I do, you know, dog-sitting services, and all of a sudden I can save lives. Yeah, I've got to come back.
As our run on television comes to an end, we've been checking in with many of these people. For many, life is still precarious. Baby Raphael's parents, who had to stay up all night to care for their son, are still staying up all night without the help of a nurse. They've had to resuscitate him at least 3 times since we last saw them, each time calling 911 for help. But young Raphael is doing better. He still needs a ventilator, but is now walking and talking. And we got a reminder of just how vulnerable the people at the margins of society can be. Remember Footy Doyle, the homeless man who finally got an apartment of his own? We found out he died a year after getting his own home. It was a fatal seizure, not on the street, but in his apartment. And Jerome Scott, the aspiring biologist who taught children on Washington's Anacostia River. He had received a full scholarship to college, but died of undiagnosed leukemia before he got the chance to go. He was 20 years old. As we updated our stories, we also learned of some great triumphs. Victor Montoya, the energized Obama campaigner in New Mexico, spearheaded the campaign to incorporate his small rural community into an official city. Now, he says, his fellow residents have a real say in their future.
Here's what I learned meeting so many of you out on the road. Now on PBS, viewers as a group care about making their world a better place and hunger for independent journalism to help them make their decisions about ways forward. We do get a lot of email and snail mail on this program. I have to say, not all of it is adoring, but a good piece of it can be summed up in a note that I got from a viewer in Connecticut. She wrote, quote, "Keep up the righteous passion. The people who have no voice rely on those of us who do to raise a ruckus." From Maria Hinojosa and me, and the rest of the Now team, we hope you found it a useful ruckus. And that's it for now on PBS. I'm David Brancaccio. Take care.